So tonight, the Sierra Club joins with Father Tim Tarr as he and I share our perspectives on the Laudato Si, or the Pope's encyclical, that was released last year by Pope Francis and was widely praised. One might look at this work as a negative piece of writing, as some actually have, but I was personally inspired by it. And I was captured by Pope Francis' vision of what the world might look like. I was also privileged to participate in a series conducted by Father Tim where the Laudato Si was examined and discussed. With the Laudato Si, Pope Francis has brought us together, Catholics and non-Catholics alike. Francis has shown himself to be a man of faith and reason, and his encyclical has started a global conversation on the state of emergency we are in with the Earth's environment and climate. So he asks us to open a dialogue. So whether we are people of faith or people of science and reason or both, we join to share in the caring for our common home, the Earth. As I learned from sitting in on the series with Father Tim and some of his congregants, we can benefit from hearing each other and realizing that we, as people of goodwill, have much in common and together can address a despair that can engulf us. So, Father Tim Tarr is the priest at St. Francis Assisi Church in Hillcrest. He's been a long-time activist, both for peace and justice. He cares about, you know, the suffering in this world. And I'm just delighted that he's here with us tonight, so let's welcome him up to the podium. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be with you, and admire your work you do. All of you, I know some of the faces here, and know all of you are really committed and have offered so much good to the community and beyond. So it's nice to be here with you tonight, and it's good for me preparing for tonight to go back to the encyclical, but go back into this document again. I always gain so much more as I go back and read what is in this encyclical, Laudato Si. But I just want to, before I begin to get into that, just to give you context. You know, in our Catholic morality, we have a whole body of teaching called Catholic social teaching. And so this fits into this whole sense of Catholic social teaching. And our Catholic social teaching began in 1891, let's say, the body of work in 1891 with the first encyclical, social encyclical on work, on labor, Rerum Novarum. And Pope Leo XIII began that. And so since 1891 through this encyclical, we have a body of doctrine that has evolved over the years. You know, if you know, at that time, the Industrial Revolution was beginning and, you know, the impact of that on culture and society. So, you know, Pope Leo XIII thought it should be an encyclical teaching. What's our morality in that? And what do we have to say about this whole phenomenon of change taking place in the world, in industrialization? Then from there, all sorts of other encyclicals have evolved. And on anniversaries, significant anniversaries of Rerum Novarum. And then let's just go back, let's jump to 1963, Pacem in Terris, you know, the Cold War at that time. Pope John the 23rd came out with this powerful encyclical, Pacem in Terris, Peace on Earth. And talking about the nuclear arms race, get rid of it. And so that was a body of teaching at that time that was pivotal. Then go up a few more years, John Paul II, you know, and the whole solidarity phenomenon with Poland, he came out with an encyclical on human work and all of that. And then there have been other bodies of teaching, and then the most recent is Pope Francis's. You know, so this is kind of a little synopsis of Catholic social teaching in this document. Just shows you there's been a long history here. And So Laudato Si is a part of that. You know, we call this as an encyclical on the environment. It is, but it's also a social encyclical because there's so much more in it. And it's to try to do this in 20 minutes is going to challenge, but it's going to be a little taste of it. You know, I think there's an interesting question in paragraph 160, just to begin with, that is raised, is what kind of world do we want to leave to those who come after us, to children who are now growing up? And I think it's a powerful question for us to ponder. It's something, as you, in being the Sierra Club, you know, are really concerned about. And all of us, what kind of world do we want to leave to future generations? So Francis asked that question. And it's like really almost the heart of the encyclical. You know, what kind of world are we leaving? You know, what is the purpose of our life in this world? You know, it causes us to ponder deeply. You know, what is the purpose of our life? What is the goal of our work and all of our efforts? You know, what need does the earth have of us? You know, and that is something that takes place for us to ponder. Questions to go deeper and reflect on. Laudato Si, it is Latin, and its translation is "Praise be to Thee." It comes from St. Francis's Canticle of Creation, and so that's where that title comes from. The common name for it is "On Care for Our Common Home." So Pope Francis invites us to listen to the earth. And there's a passage in the New Testament, the groaning of creation, you know, the groaning of creation. So Pope Francis invites us to listen to this groaning of creation and to listen to one another. And I appreciate what Scott was saying about dialogue. We'll talk about that in a few minutes, but dialogue is important in our pursuit of this. It is a hopeful encyclical. You know, it's not a doom and gloom encyclical. He certainly raises a lot of, you know, realities of our world, but it isn't to leave us hopeless. It's a real message of hope. There's a ray of hope through the whole encyclical, with him saying in chapter or paragraph 13, humanity still has the ability to work together in building our common home. So he really sees there's hope for this, you know, that we have a chance, we have an ability to work together. And he wants to engage in a dialogue with all people. And I think that's one of the significance of this encyclical. You know, he wants to enter into a dialogue with all people about our common home, he says at the very beginning. And I think this is what sets this apart, you know, from so many other encyclicals. You know, just like in the community here, Scott said we had a six-week course on this, or reflection on this. You know, had people from the Sierra Club, people from the non-Catholic community, people from our parishes, Unitarian Universalist members. So we had a wide range of people. You know, and that was the first, you know, I've been ordained 38 years, I've ever had that type of an experience, you know, with people engaged and interested in this. So this dialogue I see happening on a local level already in this community. I think the other thing too Pope Francis does in this encyclical is bring in so many other voices. And certainly one voice that he brought in right at the beginning of this is the Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew. I mean, that's unheard of too. Him, you know, the Pope going to other religion and parts of the Christian communities. So he brings in other churches and other church communities into this dialogue. And, you know, the Patriarch Bartholomew in two paragraphs is mentioned frequently. And I wanted to take just one thing here. He says, you know, we have in our Catholic community and we talk about sin. And I think this is a strong statement. And this is from Patriarch Bartholomew. Talking about sin, to commit a crime against the natural world is a sin against ourselves and a sin against God. You know, so he raises the morality of our environment to a high standard, you know, for us to consider. You know, I know, you know, when you think about sin, there's maybe one area we think a lot about sin. But he expands this whole thing to say that sin, you know, when we look at creation and in the environment, he looks at the reflections of numerous scientists, philosophers, and theologians, civic groups are all part of this body of teaching. An encyclical is a body of teaching. And it's in that doctrine of church teaching that is taken seriously. And it's going to be around for a long time, and it should be integrated into church teaching on every level. So that is the hope of the encyclical. It's six chapters. And I just want to go through the six chapters as best as I can to highlight what each of those chapters are addressing to give you an idea of what's taking place here. What I just shared with you, some of the opening part. But chapter one, you know, he looks at what is happening to our common home. What is taking place? So this first chapter presents the most recent scientific findings on the environment as a way of listening to the cry of creation. What is happening now? And he begins right away with pollution and climate change. And goes right to it. You know, saying climate change is a global problem. He doesn't say that there may be. Climate change is a global problem with serious implications in environmental, social, economic, political, and for the distribution of goods. It represents one of the principal challenges facing humanity in our day. And I think one thing you have to understand about Pope Francis, and if you have it, he takes everything. He's from Argentina, the third world. And we have a principle of Catholic social teaching that is a preferential option for the poor. That's one of our teachings in Catholic social teaching. And it's always been referred to. But I think he's the very first one who has taken, begins at that basic premise. Everything for the preferential option for the poor. So everything's a lens. That is a lens through which he really speaks and addresses his whole teaching. And this encyclical is comes from that perspective. And so he sees this whole reality of the environment. You know, the greatest impact of this change, this climate change, is on the poorest in the world. And that's where, you know, he really sees this. You know, the greatest impact of this change falls on the poorest, but many of those who possess more resources and economic or political power seem mostly to be concerned with masking the problems or concealing their symptoms. You know, so he sees there's this tension between the developed countries and the developing countries. One of the other major issues in chapter one is the issue of water. And looking at the whole reality of water, we see that certainly in this country recently with a terrible situation that's happened in Flint, Michigan, and how important and vital water is in that, you know, as he states, every day unsafe water results in many deaths in the spread of water-related diseases, including those caused by microorganisms and chemical substances. He clearly states that access to safe, drinkable water is a basic universal human right. And it is essential for our survival as human people. And we have to exercise and keep that human right available to all. He just also speaks about the loss of biodiversity, stating each year sees the disappearance of thousands of plant and animal species which we will never know, which our children will never see, because they've been lost forever. So I think in that he shows the fragility of our environment. And, you know, not to take things for granted, because they're not going to be here if they're lost now. And we have a way we need to take care of that. He talks about weak responses in this first chapter. And in the face of the drama besetting many peoples and populations, even though positive examples are not lacking, a complacency and a cheerful recklessness prevail. You know, so he addresses, the attitude in which we are in. and their faces, the challenges for this. And he talks about a global inequality that's taking place. You know, the whole sense that the inequality globally needs to be addressed. There's a big theme in Francis's teachings and his talks over the last years, and he's very strong on his encounter. You know, he has a real powerful teaching that he's giving both by word and example about encounter. And he encourages us in that encounter so that we may have a better appreciation of what's taking place in our world with the environment. So, you know, he just sets the stage as chapter one about the challenges and what's taking place in the environment and in our world. Chapter two, he talks about, and this is where he bases it in our faith tradition, in Christian scriptures, and just and in all you know, religious and spiritual traditions. He looks at our biblical accounts. And, you know, it's just to show that this is not just a scientific thing, it's a spiritual, moral challenge for all of us. We cannot neglect that this is a spiritual and moral reality for us. And so it's grounded in the spirituality and morality. And, you know, and all of our Catholic social teaching is grounded in Scripture, in the Bible, in both the Hebrew Scriptures and the Christian Scriptures. And he raises this because, you know, a lot of things have been taken out of context in the Scriptures. And he wants to address that in a strong way. And certainly, you know, the gift of creation is seen right in Genesis 1, the story of creation. And we know there's two creation accounts in the book of Genesis. And we know that one part of Genesis is sometimes misinterpreted and misused, and he addresses that human beings have the responsibility to till and keep the garden of the world. And that doesn't mean that we are to have dominion over it, domination over it. That every act of cruelty towards any creature is contrary to human dignity. That is important. We Christians have at times incorrectly interpreted the Scriptures. Nowadays, we must forcefully reject the notion that our being created in God's image and given dominion over the earth justifies absolute domination over other creatures. So he really addresses that because we know people use that line of Scripture to say, you know, we have power over creation, or we have power and can use creation for our purpose. And he gets into that a little bit more in the encyclical about our centrality as human people. Chapter three, you know, goes into the roots of the ecological crisis. This is, again, an analysis of the current situation so as to consider not only its symptoms, but also its deepest causes. It's a dialogue with philosophy and the human sciences. That is a challenging, it's a challenging chapter. He uses the whole look at our the roots of this ecological crisis, seeing that our technocratic domination so often leads to destruction of nature and the exploitation of people. And again, he addresses that our modernity has been marked by an excessive anthropocentrism in our lives, that we are self-centered. You know, we're self-centered. We put ourselves in the center of it all. And, you know, he talks about that throwaway culture we live in, you know, because it's at our disposal. Creation's at our disposal. And we have that attitude that we could just throw everything away and don't see the consequences. The encyclical addresses two crucial problems of this in today's world. It talks about the value of work, the importance of work. And that's, again, as I mentioned, the very first encyclical was on work. So it's been a big teaching in our Catholic social doctrine. And that body of work to show the value of labor in everything that we do. And he also raises the regards the limits of scientific progress. You know, it's a very complex issue. The environment issue is complex. And some ways we have to really be engaged with everyone to address this because it is so complex. There's an area here. Men and women have constantly intervened in nature, but for a long time, this meant being in tune with and respecting the possibilities offered by the things themselves. Again, he says, the economy accepts every advance in technology with a view to profit without concern for its potentially negative impact on human beings. Finance overwhelms the real economy. And I think this is interesting. The lessons of the global financial crisis have not been assimilated, and we are learning all too slowly the lessons of the environmental deterioration. He brings it, you know, the other theme in this encyclical is economic injustice. So there's many levels to the encyclical, not just on the environment, but talking about poverty, economic injustice as well. And this is woven through the whole encyclical in many ways, and in all of the chapters. And he talks about our lifestyles. In chapter 4, he looks at the whole aspect of, he calls an integral ecology. And I think that's a great phrase, integral ecology. And chapter 4, in many ways, is the heart of the encyclical, the heart of the encyclical itself. It's a new paradigm of justice, an ecology which respects our unique place as human beings in this world and our relationship to its surroundings. And I think this sense of an integral ecology is that we're all interconnected. He really stresses this through the whole encyclical, that we're all interconnected. Every violation of solidarity and civic friendship harms the environment. And nature cannot be regarded as something separate from ourselves as a mere setting in which we live. So he stresses this real deep connection that we have with creation. And, you know, he uses St. Francis. I should have said that at the beginning. You know, St. Francis in our, you know, his whole, he's loved by everyone, I think, St. Francis. Because he had just had this, he saw the integration of all creation. You know, he saw God in everything, and everything reflected God. And, you know, creation itself. Francis was interconnected with all of life. And that's what makes Francis attractive in many ways. And so that's, you know, he uses St. Francis a lot through the encyclical. And he's one, you know, St. Francis, lived an integral ecology. And it also involves everyday life, you know, how we are living. You know, the human being has a great capacity for adaptation and an admirable creativity and generosity as shown by persons and groups who respond to environmental limitations. How do we live our daily lives in an integral way with creation? Again, in this chapter, he raises, you know, our commitment to the care of the poor for today, you know, because they're most affected by what's taking place. You know, and he talks about our urban developments, you know, creating green spaces. How are we building and creating our life every day, even in our local communities? You know, that the poor have a right to green space. You know, they shouldn't just be living in places that are just brown spots and brown areas. You know, they need to live in places and have available to them parks and places where they could be connected to creation. That's a human right. And that's a right everyone deserves and should have. And so he addresses that, and it talks about this as something that is important. And the other thing too in this chapter 4 that's he raises and brings out strongly is the principle of the common good. You know, we've missed and we're missing, you know, an appreciation of the common good in our culture and our society today. Here he says, the human ecology is inseparable from the notion of the common good, a central and unifying principle of social ethics. The common good is the sum of those conditions of social life which allow social groups and their individual members relatively through thorough and ready access to their own fulfillment. So this principle of the common good is important to appreciate the challenge of answering and addressing this the global crisis. You know, because this principle of the common good means a summons for solidarity for all of us. It's not, you know, we're separate from one another. And, you know, what we do affects everyone else. And how do we appreciate that interconnectedness with one another and live that common good in our society and in our global world today? He sees consumerism and globalization, you know, somewhat in a strong way, breaking that appreciation of the common good down. And so, you know, that is a strong teaching and reconnection to the common good in this encyclical as well. In the last two chapters, 5 and 6, he talks about approach and action. You know, what can we do? What's before us? And, you know, what must we do? And this in this chapter, which I like in chapter 5, is stressing every subtext is on dialogue. He talks about dialogue in the environment, in the international community, dialogue for new national and local policies, dialogue and transparency and decision-making, politics and economy and dialogue for human fulfillment, and then lastly, religions and dialogue with science. And I think that's pretty powerful. I mean, so often we think religion and science is not together. Here he's talking about religion and science being in dialogue and appreciating that relationship, that there is no separation between religion and science. Francis is strong on dialogue, you know, and he engages in dialogue. I mean, he does it constantly. Just this past October, you know, we had a big synod. And, you know, they said, you know, we're not sure what's going to come out of it all. But he created a firestorm. And by creating a dialogue, he just kind of threw some, you know, bombs out there in a sense. And I use that in a figurative way. But to create dialogue among, and they haven't done that. The bishops haven't done that for years. So he's really appreciates how we need to talk to each other in all disciplines. And he talks about in the chapter 5, you know, about the recent summits, you know, all these global summits that have taken place. And he details each of them, you know, like the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro in 1992. He talks about that, you know, the Basel Convention. He talks about other major summits that have taken place, saying the recent world summits on the environment have failed to live up to expectations because due to lack of political will, they are unable to reach truly meaningful and effective global agreements on the environment. So he insists in this chapter on development of honest, transparent decision-making processes in order to discern what policies and business initiatives can bring about genuine, integral development. And the most significant appeal is addressed to those who hold political office. It's not timely for us. Calling them to avoid a mentality of efficiency and immediacy that is so prevalent today. But if they are courageous, they will attest to God-given dignity and leave behind a testimony of selfless responsibility. It's calling on a lot for political leaders to come up to that standard. But you know, he's challenging the nations and all of the global community. You know, we have these summits, and we, you know, Scott will go into that about Paris. You know, what's going to happen after all of these conventions? You know, where's the follow through, and how can we make them really effective in our particular communities, in our nations, in our communities itself? In chapter 6, in the last chapter here, he speaks about the ecological education and spirituality. Again, showing that the global change and the global crises, the climate crises, is not just a scientific reality. It's a moral and spiritual reality as well. And we have to look at that. You know, we're in the season of Lent, and we talk about these 40 days as a time of change, metanoia, change in our lives. And this is where he's really calling us, to a lifestyle change. I mean, he's not talking about changing light bulbs, and you know, which are good, but you know, things that we try to do. But he's talking about fundamental change in the world. You know, change is impossible without motivation and a process of education. So he's really stressing education and training as key challenges for us. And the starting point is for all of us, and he's talking to all of us, to aim for a new lifestyle. So he's talking about changing our lifestyle, our behaviors, our values, our priorities. And that's daunting in many ways. And, you know, I look at my life and the changes I need to make, you know, and anytime I read this, it's a personal challenge. As he says, an integral ecology is also made up of simple daily gestures which break the logic of violence, exploitation, and selfishness. So are we ready? And he bases his last chapter in spirituality, you know, to take on, you know, change in our lives is a spiritual journey. That we never can say we've arrived, but move forward, continue to go forward. And also the sense of education, to continue to bring this into our communities. I know just recently the Vatican addressed this for us in our Catholic community, that they want to see that the bishops are really taking this encyclical seriously, that this gets into the parishes, down to the parishes, and that parishes are addressing it. So the Vatican, I would say it wants to see this getting down to the grassroots. This was the intention of this when it was being written, and then when it was published and brought forth, that his intention was this is to get down into the parishes. And sometimes we don't hear that too often when these encyclicals are released. So I just think it's, holds so much. I encourage you to read it. I think you'll profit a lot out of it. That in your own, you know, your values and what you desire to see happen, I think you'll find some great worth in this. I think it's going to be around for a long time, and we have a challenge. I know in our Catholic community, continue to get this into our parishes, into our youth programs and adult programs. But that challenge is before us, and I know resources in our community are coming out by publishers to get this down into a teaching mode and curriculum. So I think this is just a kind of an overview of what this whole encyclical is about. He really has established a dialogue, and I think that's what's great to be here tonight with you. To be part of this, because it's in the spirit of this encyclical to continue that dialogue for all of us, no matter where we're at in our own faith traditions or personal values, that we're all concerned about our common home and how can we better care for our common home in the spirit of what Francis is speaking. So thank you very much.
Going to be hard to follow up, Father Tim. I'll do my best. And I'm going to talk mainly on the environmental component of Laudato Si with emphasis on climate change. And you're going to hear some things being repeated that Father Tim said. And I will use many quotes from the writing as they are really so rich. Pope Francis, in a remarkable way, broadens the issue of our planetary crisis to encompass the general degradation we as humans have inflicted on our planet over the last 200 years. He fully understands the reasons that are causing climate change, both with the backdrop of human nature and the economic forces. He rightfully links the degradation of our environment with the degradation of our values. He nails it when it comes to describing the effects of climate change, both now and in the future. But he received criticism by some for delving into the realm of science and politics, for as Pope, should he be speaking on things outside of religious matters? But as Tim pointed out, he's a scientist himself and did rely on a group of other scientists, both within the church and I think without. There was a professor, Hans Schellnhuber, who's the director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, that provided a lot of the input. And there were others. The result is the encyclical's comments on climate change are consistent with the scientific consensus on climate change. And going right into a good overview of what the science of climate change is and Francis's own words, warming has effects on the carbon cycle. It creates a vicious circle which aggravates the situation even more, affecting the availability of essential resources like drinking water, energy, and agricultural production in warmer regions, and leading to the extinction of part of the planet's biodiversity. The melting in the polar ice caps and in high altitude plains can lead to the dangerous release of methane gas, while the decomposition of frozen organic material can further increase the emission of carbon dioxide. Things are made worse by the loss of tropical forests, which would otherwise help to mitigate climate change. Carbon dioxide pollution increases the acidification of the oceans and compromises the marine food chain. A little bit more of an overview of the climate change issues, and I give credit to some of the following to Wikipedia. Francis, however, pulls no punches when lamenting pollution, climate change, a lack of clean water, loss of biodiversity, and an overall decline in human life and a breakdown of society. Quoting Francis, "Never have we so hurt and mistreated our common home as we have in the last 200 years." He describes a relentless exploitation and destruction of the environment, for which he blamed apathy, the reckless pursuit of profits, excessive faith in technology, and political short-sightedness. Laudato Si unambiguously accepts the scientific consensus that changes in the climate are largely man-made, and quoting Francis, "Climate change is a global problem with grave implications on environmental, social, economic, political, and for the distribution of goods. It represents one of the principal challenges facing humanity in our day and warns of unprecedented destruction of ecosystems with serious consequences for us all if prompt climate change mitigation efforts are not undertaken." The encyclical highlights the role of fossil fuels in causing climate change. Quoting Francis, "We know that technology based on the use of highly polluting fossil fuels, especially coal, but also oil and to a lesser degree gas, needs to be progressively replaced without delay. Until greater progress is made in developing widely accessible sources of renewable energy, it is legitimate to choose the less harmful alternative or to find short-term solutions." Now, looking at technology. Quoting Francis, "Technology which, linked to business interest, is presented as the only way of solving these problems, in fact proves incapable of seeing the mysterious network of relations between things, and so sometimes solves one problem only to create others. Modern technology, the dominant technological paradigm, is seen as a key contributor to the environmental crisis and human suffering." Quoting Francis, "The technological paradigm has become so dominant that it would be difficult to do without its resources, and even more difficult to utilize them without being dominated by their internal logic. Can you think of computers and communications and how we're so dependent? What do we do when they go down? Yeah. The encyclical warns against blind confidence in technical solutions, particularly in view of the fact that, and quoting Francis, the specialization which belongs to technology makes it difficult to see the large picture. Given these significant shortcomings of technology, quoting Francis, scientific and technological progress cannot be equated with progress of humanity and history. And we are deluded by the myth of progress to believe that ecological problems will solve themselves simply with the application of new technology without need for ethical consideration or deep change. A profound redefinition of progress and liberation from the dominant technocratic paradigm are needed. We can put it at the service of another type of progress, this direct technology, one which is healthier, more human, more social, more integral. Per Pope Francis, the environmental crisis can ultimately only be solved if our immense technological developments are accompanied by a, quote, development in human responsibility, values, and conscience. So Francis is not against technologies. He's just wary of its misuse and our thinking that we can just solve everything with technology alone. Now looking at the concept of global commons, and I give credit to carbonbrief.org for a number of the following. But the most important element of the encyclical is where science and morality merge in the presentation of the atmosphere as a global commons, says Otmar Edenhofer, chief economist at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. Quoting Francis, what is needed, in effect, is an agreement on systems of governance for the whole range of so-called global commons. This would mean treating the atmosphere as a common property of mankind and regulating it accordingly, rather than allowing it to be freely accessible to whoever wants it without penalty and pollute it. Edenhofer says, it seems to me that the most fundamental and revolutionary sentence in the encyclical is where it says climate is a global commons, which means a global commons for all and by all human beings. Now looking at the limits of science and the IPCC. The encyclical is a case of the Pope doing what science cannot. Last year in Berlin, government representatives met to approve line by line the summary for policymakers of the IPCC's Working Group 3 report. As co-chair Edenhofer watched on as delegates from countries as diverse as the U.S., Tanzania, Canada, South Sudan, and France objected to the inclusion of the phrase global commons in the IPCC summary document, which is forwarded to governments around the world. Their concern was that this could be seen as a political statement in what is supposed to be a policy-neutral document. The idea of the global commons was eventually relegated to a footnote which stresses that it has no specific implications for legal arrangements. And according to Peter Raven of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, the genesis of the encyclical lay in the frustration of scientists about the near stagnant efforts to tackle climate change compared to the urgency of their own research. This is what makes the encyclical even more powerful than the IPCC, he tells the Carbon Brief. I think the scientific community felt rather stranded with the need for action and the relative inability of science itself to generate that action. And now we have a real call for action, which comes from a morally high-placed and very authoritative source. Partha Dasgupta, Emeritus Professor at the University of Cambridge, who has been a key player in the scientific events leading up to the encyclical, praised the Pope's treatment of economics. He tells Carbon Brief, "His treatment of economics is expert. What he adds to the subject is the appeal to not treat nature altogether like the commodities that appear in economics textbooks. Relying entirely on getting the price of natural capital right is a mistake." I read him as saying that ultimately we have to relate differently to nature, regard it as part of ourselves, otherwise we'll mistreat it to our detriment. And that echoes what we heard last month from Professor Jason Moore, who spoke here on capitalism in the web of life. However, Edenhofer stresses that we should not perceive this encyclical as a kind of substitute for an IPCC document. He says it is complementary, adding, "It is not a document which wants to prescribe the international negotiations. The Pope wants to highlight, focus, and emphasize fundamental ethic principles. In the IPCC, we said something on ethics, but not too much. Science is very limited in its capacity to emphasize ethical principles." This is his role, the Pope. I'll speak a little bit now on lines of approach and action, and this is in the context of failure of leadership. In Chapter 5, he states that reducing greenhouse gases requires honesty, courage, and responsibility. He says national interests cannot be placed above the common good. The overall approach to solving the crisis has to be the reduction of pollution, along with the development of poorer countries. True statecraft has to be dominant over politics, and he calls for public pressure and local activism. Quoting Francis, "Interdependence obliges us to think of one world with a common plan, yet the same ingenuity which has brought about enormous technological progress has so far proved incapable of finding effective ways of dealing with grave environmental and social problems worldwide. A global consensus is essential for confronting the deeper problems, which cannot be resolved by unilateral action on the part of individual countries." Pope Francis further challenges the idea that market forces can adequately safeguard the environment. Profit should not be the sole criteria used in decisions affecting the climate and environment. Technologically advanced societies must be prepared to encourage more sober lifestyles. We must redefine our notion of progress and reduce consumption. Then there is the economic and social cost of using up shared planetary resources. And Father Tim had touched on lifestyles. I'm going to do more on that now, and the idea of revolution. Pope Francis speaks about the threat of global warming in terms of our weakened communities. Quoting Francis, "We have created a throwaway culture which excludes. The pollution of the planet," he claims, "is just a byproduct of the increasingly insular ways we conduct ourselves, separate from natural systems, separate from one another, separate from our spiritual core. Climate change solutions cannot stop with crafting corporate and political behavior alteration, though they must absolutely begin there. We must have," quoting Francis, "a revolution that comes about through tenderness, through the joy, which always becomes closeness and compassion." Francis warns us against abstractly approaching climate change as purely a matter of science and economy, inspiring us to remain grounded in human dignity. "The realities of irreparable climate change will have harrowing effects for families and communities, especially amongst the world's poor. This process has already begun to a monumental degree." Quoting Francis, "A very solid scientific consensus indicates that we are presently witnessing a disturbing warming of the climatic system. Humanity is called to recognize the need for change of lifestyle, production, and consumption in order to combat this warming, or at least the human causes which produce or aggravate it." I have a recap, which maybe we'll do a little later. I'm going to skip that and get to the Paris Climate Summit, otherwise known as Conference of Parties, COP21. So just recently, the Paris Climate Talks had concluded. It was the grandest coordinated climate change demonstration in history that occurred there. Parisians, for their part, lined up rows and rows of shoes, taking a virtual stand against short-sighted solutions and glib political stonewalling. Pope Francis quietly sent along shoes of his own to Paris, proceeding to not so quietly warn world leaders against another tepid take to global warming. "We are at the limits of suicide," he affirms. "It is now or never." Pope Francis warned that the world is facing a grave environmental crisis and spoke of the intersection between social justice and the protection of nature. The Pope's comments, made in the Kenyan capital at the start of his first visit to the continent, came just days ahead of the UN climate summit, where global delegates were to hammer out an agreement to curb climate change. Quoting Francis, "We have a responsibility to pass on the beauty of nature and its integrity to future generations, and an obligation to exercise a just stewardship of the gifts we have received." Then Pope Francis praised what he called an historic agreement reached at the UN Climate Change Summit and called for a global commitment to implement it, including special attention to the poorest populations. He urged the international community to quote, "pay special attention to the most vulnerable populations and to carefully follow the road ahead and with an ever-growing sense of solidarity." And I'll end with one more quote from Francis. "In effect, there is a clear link between the protection of nature and the building of a just and equitable social order. There can be no renewal of our relationship with nature without a renewal of humanity itself." And that's referencing what was in his encyclical, but he said that in light of what happened at Paris. So I am done with what I wanted to say, and I'll take questions, and we can ask Father Tim to come back up.
I think the other thing he addresses too is, and I think it's all over the place, is indifference. And he really challenges the indifference we have to a lot of things, the indifference to, well, the environment, and the indifference to, the global warming and climate change, that we can't remain indifferent. He talks a lot about indifference, our indifference to the poor, and in the economy that has no concern for the poor, challenging us and our moral and ethics about that sense of indifference. His World Day Message of Peace on January 1st was on the whole idea of indifference, raises that as a real moral issue.
The Pope really deals quite a bit with economic situation and structure. He targets current models of production and consumption, business interests and consumerism, huge global economic interests, present model of distribution where a minority believes that it has the right to consume in a way which can never be universalized, new power structures based on their techno-economic paradigm, powerful financial interest, and when nature is viewed solely as a source of profit and gain, this has serious consequences for society. And finally, the culture of consumerism, which prioritizes short-term gain.
I think the concern for the developed countries, first world countries, have a responsibility to help those in the developing countries to have a sustenance of life. And we have a responsibility helping them to a quality of life that, are not going to have what we have, but a quality of life that's worth their dignity.